I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and on this 7th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks, we want to begin with a conversation with Kenneth Feinberg. He's the Washington lawyer and compensation expert who was asked to do the seemingly impossible job of putting a price tag on the value of the thousands of lives lost on 9/11. As special master of the September 11th Victims Compensation Fund, he had to work within rules established by Congress, but based on the judicial system, with more money given to survivors of people who made more money before they died. Well, now Kenneth Feinberg says never again. He is the author of What is Life Worth? The Unprecedented Effort to Compensate the Victims of 9/11. And he joins us from the Christian Science Monitor Studios in Washington with more. Ken, welcome.
Thank you.
And I know this is a powerful day for you, so thanks for speaking to us on this day. But let's remind us, take us back and remind us what happened after 9/11. The nation was reeling. Congress passed the federal September 11th Victim Compensation Fund of 2001 law, and Attorney General John Ashcroft asked you to run it, and you said yes. Why did you, first of all, respond?
Well, I said yes because I think probably if John Ashcroft had asked millions of Americans, they would have said yes. I had had some experience in the past in fashioning and administering compensation systems in court, the Agent Orange Vietnam veterans case, Dalcon Shield contraceptive case, asbestos litigation. So I had had some experience in trying to deal with valuing claims that go to court. This was quite different because 11 days after 9/11, Congress passed this non-judicial alternative to the legal system. Congress basically said anybody who wants to voluntarily give up their right to go to court against the airlines, the World Trade Center, and instead enter a no-fault administrative compensation system could do so.
There were some survivors who were angry about this initially. You know, they thought it robbed them of an opportunity for compensation, but also for bringing others to task.
Well, there was a good deal of angst at the beginning of the program. Ultimately, in the 33 months of the program's existence, 97% of all eligible claimants, over 5,000 people, entered the program voluntarily, and only 94 people who lost a loved one on 9/11 decided to litigate in court rather than enter the fund.
Well, so there were some people who were questioning the fund itself, but were you initially?
No, I thought it was the right thing to do. I thought it expressed the solidarity of the American people towards the victims. At the same time, Congress was very concerned, of course, that if we didn't set up a fund like this, you'd have all sorts of litigation against the airlines, which would bring the airlines to their knees, and Congress didn't want to see that happen.
Yeah. Well, you work pro bono with your firm. You spent 2 years investigating claims, deciding benefits. There were 1,500 hearings with survivors and victims' families. And you conducted most of them personally. What would happen? How would you do that?
This was a harrowing experience. Over 2 years, I met with 1,500 individuals and listened to their tales, their stories about a lost loved one at the World Trade Center, on the airplane, a burn victim with burns over 85% of her body. They would come to see me, not to talk about compensation, but to talk about a lost loved one, to value the life of somebody who was no longer around.
So you were the receptor for a lot of pain at that time.
A lot of pain, a lot of anger, a lot of grief, a lot of frustration at life's unfairness.
And this is all very subjective, but on the other hand, you have a law that is pretty much hard math. We'll talk about how you had some discretion with that math, but tell us about what the law said about eligibility and compensation. How did it work?
Eligibility, very simple. Anybody who died or anybody who was physically injured could voluntarily come into this fund. Once you were in the fund, I was required by statute to do what judges and juries do every day across our country, and that is calculate what would the person have earned but for 9/11. And I found that to be not only a very, very difficult task, but I found that the very idea of giving different amounts of money to individual claimants fueled the very type of divisiveness that the fund was designed to avoid.
Why? What were some of the things you were hearing?
Mr. Feinberg, you're giving $4 million to my next-door neighbor who lost her husband, who was a banker working for Enron, and you're only giving me $3 million when my husband died, a hero fireman at the World Trade Center. Why are you devaluing his life? Why is the next-door neighbor getting $1 million more than me? Well, Mrs. Jones, the next-door neighbor was a banker, was earning much more than a fireman, and blah, blah, blah. They didn't want to hear that. Claimants didn't want to hear so soon after 9/11 that a lost loved one was only worth $1 million less than the next-door neighbor.
And it was based on the income, but also other things. You could deduct collateral sources of income like insurance.
I was required to. Next-door neighbor gets a check from the U.S. Treasury for $2 million, whereas another claimant gets only $1 million because that claimant, who lost his wife, had the foresight to buy $1 million worth of life insurance, which I was required to offset. So you'd get the same problem of horizontal inequity. Mr. Feinberg, my wife worked in the same job as the next-door neighbor. I'm getting $1 million less because we bought life insurance. I don't get it, Mr. Feinberg. I just don't get it. Well, those were problems.
And you, as I said, you had some discretion with the hard formulas within the law, right? You did sort of, after you ran the numbers, you did bring down some and bring up others.
Yes. If I didn't bring down some of those high-end wage earners, they would have received $20 million, $30 million totally of the taxpayers' money. Well, Congress never intended that.
Well, so all of this, the fact that there was some discretion, the fact that there were hard formulas, is creating very hard feelings. But then it branches out because you start hearing from people who weren't even at 9/11 but maybe were at other catastrophes.
Absolutely. Mr. Feinberg, my daughter died in Oklahoma City. Where's my check? Mr. Feinberg, my son died on the USS Cole fighting terrorists in Yemen when he was the victim of the suicide bombing. Where's my check? Mr. Feinberg, I don't get it. My wife died in the basement of the World Trade Center in the 1993 terrorist attacks committed by the very same people. Why aren't I eligible? So you see, when Congress created this program and limited it only to 9/11, it called into question all of those other citizens of our nation who are the victims of life's misfortune through no fault of their own, but they weren't eligible to receive $2, $3, $4 million.
Well, the fund, the 9/11 fund, also had a deadline, and some families didn't meet it, even though you tried to encourage them to do so. You offered to fill out the forms, I think I read. But some families couldn't even deal with it. So you have this issue going as well.
Well, you had 11 families who were so overcome by grief and the loss of a family member that they were paralyzed and unable to even fill out a form that they would have received on average $2 million, tax-free. They couldn't fill it out. They couldn't sign it. And at the end of the day, they said, please, Mr. Feinberg, leave it on the kitchen table. I can't deal with this.
How did you deal with this? How did you deal with the people pulling at your, you know, sleeves, asking for funds, trying to get other people to fill out forms, the inequity? How did you, the happenstance?
I dealt with it with great difficulty for 33 months. But when the president of the United States and the Congress and everybody, the press and the American people were behind me 100% on this program, when they're all there asking, you know, just keep going and get it done. It's important for the nation. You soldier on. I had great support from my family. But occasionally I would have to take a walk around the block. I must tell you, when you meet these families and you hear these stories, one lady came to see me, 24 years old, with tears streaming down her face. She said, Mr. Feinberg, I lost my husband at the World Trade Center. He was a fireman. And he left me with our two children, 6 and 3. And I understand I'm going to get $1 million, Mr. Feinberg, but I want it in the next month. I said to her, well, Mrs. Jones, I'll try, but it takes time with the U.S. Treasury, etc. We have to verify all the claim and all of that, the corroboration. Why do you need it in a month? And she said, I have terminal cancer. I have only 8 weeks to live. My husband was going to survive me and take care of our two children. Now they're going to be orphans. And I need that money so I can set up a trust in the next few weeks while I'm still around. And we accelerated payment of that money, and about 7 weeks later, we went to her funeral. Now, you couldn't dream up stories like this. So it was tough. But giving people an opportunity to be heard, I think, had a great deal to do with the success, ultimate success of the program.
Well, you say ultimate success of the program. But then we understand, and you did a This I Believe essay for NPR. Listeners might have heard it. You know, I understand you made a vow never again, and you're a compensation lawyer. Tell us how your thinking was affected.
Well, you see, I thought it turned out to be a mistake. You shouldn't ask one person to administer and design a program where the law requires you to give every single eligible person a different amount of money. If you want to set up a compensation program, and I believe the 9/11 fund, by the way, was the right thing to do. I think it was the right thing. It was a unique response to an unprecedented national tragedy. But if you're going to do it again, A, don't do it again. Don't single out for very generous compensation just a few people who are the victims of a curveball. Life throws curveballs at all of us, and we're not entitled to $2 million tax-free. But if you're going to do it again, Congress, give everybody, whether it's the waiter, the busboy, the fireman, the cop, the soldier, or the stockbroker, the same amount of money. Don't attempt to calibrate what somebody is, quote, worth, unquote. Now, with the 9/11 fund, there was no choice, you see, because Congress was determined to try and divert people out of suing. Once you tie a compensation program to a requirement that those who are eligible must surrender their right to sue, then you have to give people a different amount because everybody's makes different amounts of compensation. The stockbroker isn't going to give up her right to sue for the same amount that the waiter or the busboy needs. So that was the difficulty Congress confronted. So I understand why Congress did what it did. I'm just suggesting that if there is a next time, and I hope there won't be, Congress should consider providing the same amount for every eligible claimant.
But there was a next time for you. That's Kenneth Feinberg. He was also asked to manage the private memorial fund set up for the families of the victims of the Virginia Tech massacre in 2007. Difficult conversation, but we'll have that with him after a break, here and now. Still ahead today, an epic poem based on Dante and 9/11, but we want to finish our conversation with Ken Feinberg. He's the attorney who managed the September 11th Victims Compensation Fund. And Ken, before the break, we were saying how your thinking changed. You said it was a mistake to ask one person to administer a program that required you to give everyone a different amount of money. And if there was a next time, it would be done differently. And there was another time. You were also asked to manage the compensation fund for the 32 victims of the Virginia Tech massacre in 2007.
Altogether different. Virginia Tech was all private money. There was no statute. That was just private charitable donations, unsolicited, sent to Virginia Tech. And that $8 million plus, there we gave each of the 32 families who lost a loved one as a result of the shootings about $212,000 each. And we had a graduated payment program for those physically injured, the students and faculty who were physically injured, depending on the number of days you were in the hospital.
Was this something where you had a chance, you know, again, different situation entirely, but was this something that where you had, you felt you had a chance to carry out, you know, what you feel compensation programs should be? Was this sort of, you know, sort of a validating thing for you to be able
That's
to do
right.
that way?
That's right. in Virginia Tech, I didn't confront a federal statute which was tied to the tort system, which required me to give every claimant a different amount of money. So in Virginia Tech, the administration at Virginia Tech said, Ken, here is $8 million. How best do we distribute it? Answer, 32 dead each get the same, whether they're a faculty member, a wage earner, or a freshman at the school. Let's not try and distinguish characteristics among claimants. And as to the physically injured, those who were wounded by the gunman, or those who jumped out a window to escape, let's give them an amount depending on the number of days they were in the hospital. And that worked out quite well.
And because you had learned from your past experience. But I'm just wondering, Ken Feinberg, you know, as you say, you, God forbid it ever has to happen again, but if it does, you'd not want to see a compensation fund set up the way the 9/11 one was. But I'm just wondering, isn't that the basis of, as horrible as it is, of all of our insurance, of all of our judicial claims, that people are paid what they make? And if you don't follow that, you have someone who was living in a home, perhaps married to someone who was a stockbroker, and they had a lifestyle that maybe without that payment she can't keep. I'm just playing devil's advocate, you know.
It's a devil's advocacy that is very reasonable, what you say. No matter what you do, the minute the government gets into the business of compensating victims, there is going to be allegations of unfairness, inequity. I think it goes with the territory. That is why I think, although the 9/11 fund worked, and I think from the perspective of the American people, it was the right thing to do. Not from the perspective of the victims, but from the perspective of the nation that wanted to respond to 9/11 by showing the world the resolve and the solidarity of the American people towards the victims. I think it's unwise in a time of national tragedy like this to tie everybody's compensation to a different lodestar. That is, what did the person earn? Now, judges and juries do it every day in Boston, in Washington, and every village and hamlet in this country. But they usually do it, you know, based on local community mores, one case at a time, no comparisons. Here, 5,000 people were being compensated, and they were looking at each other's checks and wondering why I'm getting less than my next-door neighbor. And that was very, very problematic.
Well, Ken Feinberg, we know that since 9/11, you've been spending more time in the classrooms. In fact, you're going to be speaking about compensation issues at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst today on this anniversary. What is the one thing you want to tell young people in particular?
I like to tell young people at University of Mass and elsewhere two conclusions about all of this. One is, don't plan too far into the future. Don't be too concerned about what your resume looks like in undergraduate school. Life has a way of changing you and diverting you on what you think is your chosen path. So don't be too concerned about what you're going to be doing 5 years from now. And the second thing I've learned from all of this is what a wonderful opportunity it is to serve the nation, public service. It was the most rewarding, most challenging undertaking, assignment I ever had. I'm glad I did it. It could only be done pro bono without compensation. I could never have justified taking a penny for doing this type of thing on behalf of the American people. But public service is a wonderful thing. You can serve in so many different ways and feel good about it.
Here we are on the 7th anniversary. We know you're speaking at the school, but how will you mark this day?
Well, with remembrance and prayer. I also plan to attend some seminars and classes at the University of Massachusetts, meet with some students, talk about the 9/11 fund in historical perspective, gain the perspective, I think, also of what students think about 9/11. You know, it was 7 years ago, and some of these students now look at 9/11, I think, with a historical lens, not with a sort of contemporary, I remember where I was that day lens. And it'll be interesting what the historical perspective is of some students who are now just trying to imagine what it must have been like that day in American history.
Imagine that. Ken Feinberg, in charge of the fund created by Congress for the victims of the 9/11 attacks. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Just a note, tomorrow on Here and Now we'll have New York Times columnist Joe Nocera on the future of Lehman Brothers and the Fannie Mae Freddie Mac bailout. That's tomorrow. And still ahead today, conservative Christian Dr. Richard Land on why Sarah Palin can lead the country but not a congregation and other aspects of the culture wars. It's after the news, Here and Now. Positive polarization has been achieved. That was Pat Buchanan's response to Sarah Palin's speech at the Republican convention last week. Buchanan said Palin reignited the war the right lives for, the culture war, and the right to life. Well, is it a dangerous call? In July, a man shot and killed two people at a progressive church in Tennessee. Anti-liberal books from prominent conservative broadcasters were found in his home. Well, earlier this week, we spoke to historian Rick Perlstein, who traced the culture war back to Richard Nixon and Buchanan's own call for one in 1992. We promised on Monday we'd hear from our next guest. Dr. Richard Land is the longtime president of the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. His latest book is The Divided States of America, What Liberals and Conservatives Are Missing in the God and Country Shouting Match. And Dr. Land, last week we saw Mitt Romney, a very wealthy former East Coast governor, sneer at East Coast elites. New York Mayor Giuliani saying Democrats didn't think Wasilla, Alaska was cosmopolitan enough. Wedge after wedge, none of it from Democrats. Do you think polarization is good, is a Christian thing?
Well, first of all, sometimes polarization is reality. And, the old joke about people who are paranoid, well, sometimes they really are after you. And there clearly is a great feeling out there in middle America that the entertainment industry and many of the national media and the media elites look down on them and think that they cling to religion and guns.
Well, you referenced Barack Obama's comment in San Francisco. Uh-huh. We talked about that on Monday, and his backers said he was just trying to help people to understand how people felt disenfranchised. You say that he was casting people in the middle of the country as clinging to guns and religion. And, there was a comment a long time ago from Ann Richards of Texas saying the first George Bush was born with a silver foot in his mouth. But who's fueling it now? I mean, Gail Collins writes in the New York Times, wait a minute, Sarah Palin talked about monuments to war heroes in small towns. I'm in a big city. We have monuments to war heroes as well. It feels as if the right is laughing at community organizers, and we're hearing from tons of community organizers saying, wait a minute, I lean to the right and I work for a church. So who's fueling it now?
Well, whenever you're talking about categories that are social categories, you're going to oversimplify and you're going to have people who are going to feel, well, that's not me. But let's understand, Sarah Palin was responding to her being ridiculed for being the governor of Alaska.
Ridiculed or questioned?
I think ridiculed. I don't think you can read the blogs. I don't think you can read Maureen Dowd and not call that ridicule.
But Barack Obama said that the family is absolutely off the table, and in fact, he was the son of an 18-year-old mother.
I applaud him for that. Obama is not the one that's been leading this, but he's ending up paying the price for it because, it appears, as Camille Paglia has pointed out on her blog on Slate, the left-wing feminists in this country, many of them are outraged that a woman would dare to be some other kind of feminist than the kind that they approve. It's the same reaction that many professional African-American leaders had against Clarence Thomas. You can't be black and be conservative, they were saying. That's not legitimate. Well, guess what? There are many women like my wife who has a PhD and is a mother of three and has worked outside the home who is pro-life and who is an evangelical Christian and who sees in Sarah Palin a person who's a spokesperson for the kind of feminism she believes in.
I just want to point out that Dr. Laura Schlesinger, who's an extremely conservative talk show host, also criticized Sarah Palin for working outside the home or thinking she could take on the vice presidency with small children.
Which shows that there is diversity, even in conservatism.
Well, you know, you just said you applauded Barack Obama, but you also wrote about some of the comments he made. Barack Obama, when asked about sex education, said that if one of his daughters made a mistake and was pregnant out of wedlock, he wouldn't want her to be punished with a child. Now, the full comment was, with a sexually transmitted disease. Now, you say those who criticize the Palin family don't understand, we don't see babies as punishment. But couldn't his comment also have meant that babies shouldn't be lessons for children, young parents, that babies deserve to be brought into the world when parents are educated and ready? What's wrong with sex education
prior to that? I didn't criticize that. Well, I criticized
it. But you left it out. And I'm just wondering, would you be for sex education, maybe even more sex education, maybe more federally funded sex education?
Well, it depends on how you define sex education. I'm not for passing out condoms to minors. I'm for abstinence first.
But we have a very public illustration, and if Sarah Palin is vice president, I'm sure the country will be falling in love, as they always do, with children in the White House. We'll have a very public demonstration of how abstinence only didn't work.
Well, abstinence works every time it's tried. Clearly, if you're practicing abstinence, you don't get pregnant. I'm not going to criticize her daughter. Children make mistakes.
And neither am I.
And I'm for age-appropriate sex education. If you look at the package that Senator Obama supported in Illinois, I think it's far too explicit for kindergartners.
Well, let me jump in there, because there is an ad from the McCain campaign today that says when Obama was in the Illinois Senate, he backed comprehensive sex ed for kindergartners. Now, according to the New York Times, fact checkers, that's wrong. The bill, which was never passed, offered parents an opt-out, but also only called for age-appropriate sex ed. And at the time, Barack Obama said he understood that to mean that kindergartners would only be learning how to protect themselves from predators.
Well, that's not my understanding.
Okay. Well, let's move to some other questions. Linda Brinson, who's editorial page editor for the Winston-Salem Journal, wrote in an editorial that you said to Christianity Today that your ecstasy over the choice of Sarah Palin didn't mean that you changed your position on whether a woman could lead a church, that you're still against that. Can you explain how a woman could possibly lead a country but not lead a congregation?
That's real simple. It has nothing to do with any inequality in women. It has to do with the teaching of the New Testament. And, you know, we live in a country where we have free exercise of religion. We believe, as Baptists, that the New Testament prohibits a woman being in pastoral authority in a local church, and we believe that a woman is not to be in authority in the home. We believe that the Apostle Paul told Timothy in 1 Timothy and in 2 Timothy, a woman is not to be in authority in the local church, and the pastoral office is a position of authority. This is a position, by the way, that we share with Roman Catholicism.
Do you understand, though, how some might see a whiff of hypocrisy in that someone can not just lead a congregation in prayer but can potentially lead a country? And it's the same hypocrisy they might see in how the right vilified some well-known celebrities who, you know, made the mistake of getting pregnant when they were young, or the Gloucester fishermen's daughters up here in Massachusetts who became pregnant. They were vilified on talk radio, and yet, thankfully, Bristol Palin isn't being vilified by the same people. But how do you respond when people say there's hypocrisy here?
Well, I don't think it is hypocrisy at all. We as Baptist Christians believe that the New Testament teaches that women are not to be in pastoral authority in a local church.
Dr. Richard Land of the Southern Baptist Convention, and as to pregnancy, you've told us you condemn all premarital sex, Jamie Lynn Spears or Bristol Palin, but you applaud the choice to have the child. Dr. Land's latest book, The Divided States of America, What Liberals and Conservatives Are Missing in the God and Country Shouting Match. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, Dr. Lin, there are many people listening, I'm sure, who would applaud whatever people want to do inside their own churches. But what about the concern that Sarah Palin might bring her faith into the Oval Office? We heard her speak just this past summer, June 8th, at the Wasilla Assembly of God Church, her home church, her first church. In talking about Iraq, she asked the congregation to pray that the leaders would understand that they're being sent out on a task from God. Now, a lot of people would say, well, okay, I don't mind if you pray for something, but it's when you think God is telling you to do something that they are concerned. And let's listen to Ed Collins. He's the pastor at the church, her former pastor. And here he is speaking about the state and Alaska's role.
And I believe Alaska is one of the refuge states. Come on, you guys, in the last days. And hundreds and thousands of people are going to come to the state to seek refuge, and the church has to be ready to minister to them. Amen?
The pastor talking about the last days, the rapture, when the world is, according to revelations in the Bible, to end. Do you understand people's concerns? And she, by the way, Sarah Palin, was standing right next to the pastor on stage nodding as he was speaking. The people might be concerned that someone who believes in the last days and in war being a task from God, that sounds ominously like those who attacked the U.S. They felt they were on a mission from God. Do you understand their worry that she would bring that thinking into the Oval Office or the White House?
First of all, as Bill Clinton pointed out in preface to Madeleine Albright's book, The Mighty and the Almighty, one cannot separate one's religious faith from who one is. And you should be upfront about your religious faith and how that religious faith would apply. Barack Obama has made it very clear that he believes his religious faith leads him to certain beliefs about what economic policy should be.
Well, he was also vilified for comments that his preacher made that people thought were too fundamental.
That's right, and there were many people who were very upset about that, and I would say that if they're upset about him being vilified over Jeremiah Wright's comments, then they should be equally upset about Sarah Palin being vilified for her pastor's comments. I, for one, thought that Obama tried to distinguish where he disagreed with Wright without dissing his pastor, and his pastor threw him under the bus. I mean, I felt like Jeremiah Wright treated Barack Obama terribly, saying, well, you know, he's a politician. He just is saying what politicians have to say, basically accusing his church member of being a liar, which I found to be absolutely horrific.
Dr. Richard Land, we're running out of our time with you. I just want to make sure I've asked you about the title of your book.
Mm-hmm.
If you could very briefly tell us, what is it that you think that both liberals and conservatives don't understand, don't get?
The book's an equal opportunity offender. The chapter on what conservatives are getting wrong basically says that conservatives too often assume that God is on their side, and we can never make that assumption. We have to do our very best to make certain that we try to be on God's side.
Well, so would you say that Sarah Palin perhaps shouldn't have said that war is a task from God?
Well, Sarah Palin can defend her own statements. I think that sometimes wars are necessary. Now, the chapter on what I think liberals are getting wrong basically can be summarized this way. I think too often, too many liberals think that God doesn't have a side on issues, and I'm willing to acknowledge that God may not have a side when it comes to trade policy, but when it comes to the sanctity of all human life, from conception to natural death and everywhere in between, God is pro-life.
And I want to add that from those who hold that belief, we understand you mean across the board, you're against capital punishment as well?
No, I'm not.
Well,
And most people who are pro-life are not against capital punishment because we believe that the only way that society can pay fitting tribute to the heinousness of what they've done is to demand the forfeiture of their lives.
Well, Dr. Joel Hunter, the conservative minister, just told us last week that for him, pro-life means against capital punishment as well.
Well, there you go. The caricature of the monolithic conservative religious group in America has been shattered once again.
Dr. Richard Land, longtime president of the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. His latest book is The Divided States of America, What Liberals and Conservatives Are Missing in the God and Country Shouting Match. Dr. Land, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, still to come today, the epic poem to mark the September 11th attacks. Back with that in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Veteran CBS News producer Thomas Flynn was in his garden on the lower end of Manhattan on September 11th, 7 years ago, when he heard the sound like a screeching hawk, then a pop like a softball into the catcher's mitt. It was the first plane hitting the World Trade Center. He grabbed pen and pad and trusty bike and rode towards the story. Then he became engulfed in it, first watching people plummet to their deaths, then taking refuge from the cloud caused by the collapsed tower with a small group of survivors in a parking garage that filled with dust and threatened to entomb him.
Hope is squeezed from me. My sanctuary turned coffin grows ever deep, dark and airless. Then comes a voice. It carries reassurance, a gentle sound of caring and generosity. Did Bike Man make it? This brings a smile to my ashen face. I brighten inside this sarcophagus, where I am swallowed up and pushed to rest in peace, draped in a final coat of dust. It is the voices of others who have not given up that keeps me from curling down. I move, I breathe, I live. I open my mouth against the harsh cloud. Bike Man is here, I reply.
Caked in grime, Tom went on air with Dan Rather later that day, but now, years later, he's telling his story in a 73-page long epic poem called Bike Man. And Tom Flynn joins us from NPR's New York Bureau with more. Welcome.
Thank you.
Quite something to read this. We understand, obviously, inspired by what happened to you that day, but also inspired by a rereading of Dante and the Rings of Hell in Dante's Inferno?
I was rereading it by chance. At the same time, I was reviewing the notes that I had taken during all of 9/11. And during a bike ride, the worlds began to run together, the world of Dante's hell and the world of the hell of Ground Zero. And the words started to come to me. And it worked together. I got home from my bike rides each day, and I wrote some more of it. And by the end of the summer, I had finished the first draft of it.
Well, and it would seem like the only way you could tell about what you saw, because, you know, some of these descriptions we're about to hear are not for the faint-hearted, but you saw people falling like rag dolls from the sky, flung down by an angry, spoiled child. You see a woman jump, blown against a building, and you talk about being almost embarrassed to witness her death.
Right. It was the first time I'd addressed it. In fact, I still don't really speak of it. I've written it. But some of that is really tough going for me, still to this day.
Well, and I don't want to ask you to do something you're not comfortable with, but I was hoping there's a scene, too, as you walk away from the towers, where it suddenly turned, you know, day has turned into night, and you come across a man. And I'm wondering if you could read for us just that portion of what was happening around the towers.
Sure. Like a sail in a Nantucket fog, looming up unexpectedly, I'm startled to see a man but a few feet from me. He is quiet, staring down. I regard him closely, wondering what has his eye. Then I see. Like a schoolboy intent on his final exam, he studies his legs. His trousers are two-toned, light brown at the belt and waist, red from the knees and below to the shoes. His blood spreads into the dust he stands on. He is quiet, as is everything.
Well, you continue with your bike, past this man, others, and describe another scene. Now, we forget the towers were located on the Hudson River, and you come around the corner at one point, and as you write, you'd seen people dying in the air, dying in the fire, and now a new horror, dying in the water. And as hard as it is for us to read it, we get how hard it was for you. You can't even see it. It's hard for you to accept what you're seeing.
A lot of my senses were really deadened, it seemed. Although I know there was sound there at some points, I couldn't hear it. I know that were things to see, but I couldn't see them, mostly because of the ash. It was so deep and dark. And my journalist's curiosity was also dimmed because of the experience of seeing so many people and going through this horrible, horrible day.
It seems as if one of the only ways to describe it is in, you know, simile. Things were like other things.
They were like other things because there was a reach to try to figure out, well, how do you describe something that's almost indescribable? as a person writing poetry who hadn't done it before, I kept trying and trying so hard to present the morning accurately.
Here's your description of the towers before they collapsed. You look up and you see all the inferno, and it's like an angry monster dog's head or something, I think you say. And later, it's alive. You know, the concrete skin bellies out like the throat of a frog about to croak. It sounds as if, you know, the unreality of it. And here you are. You're a hard news, stick-to-the-facts reporter.
Right. That was interesting because things slowed down for me when the building started to collapse. And I tried to express that here.
Well, as we've been saying, later when you read Dante, it gave you a way to think about expressing it in poetry form. But when it was all happening and you were in the parking garage and everything was encased in dust, did you really, as you say in the poem in Bike Man, did you really think of Pompeii?
I did. I thought of Pompeii. It's odd. There are people who are, they're still there. Their bodies are still there. Or the forms of their bodies are still there as they tried to get away from the dust of Mount Vesuvius who exploded right there above them. And that was an image that was in my mind. I thought, oh boy, well, I'm going to join them, because I was curious when I saw them what they were thinking, what was going through their mind as they tried to get away. And here I was almost in the exact same situation, save it was a different kind of volcano.
Huh. Those who study poetry have praised your writing. Have other survivors or people who were, you know, there that day who, like you, sort of escaped it narrowly, have they said to you what, you know, how it reads to them?
Yes, they have. Some of them talk about how it was less than light and less than day after the tower collapsed. But people come up to me who were all over the world. I think it was such a shared experience that it's everybody's story, because everybody did get to watch it at the same time.
Well, you're right in that, you know, through television, so many of us saw, how'd you describe it, the munch?
The munch screamers.
Munch screamers. You could see them but not hear them because the wind was, you know, carrying their voices away. I mean, do you feel a special obligation to those people because you walked away with some of them?
I did feel a huge obligation, a responsibility, and always will. All of us who were there, who breathed the dust from there, were breathing the remains of the people who had died. There's no way around it. I was speaking to a woman in Chatham on Cape Cod who'd lost a brother who was in the building at the time. They found nothing of him, not even a fingernail, is the way she put it. And she wanted to hold my hand because I was perhaps carrying what remained of her brother, you know?
Tom Flynn, author of Bike Man, an epic poem. Thanks so much for speaking to us about it.
You're quite welcome, Robin.
And we leave you with some of the closing stanzas of Tom's poem.
I join a group of calm, bewildered, meandering, eerie sleepwalkers stumbling away from the foul, wretched place. We turn and proceed uptown through the canyons of woe. It is a slow, staggering march out of hell. A long, languid, lugubrious snake of sadness. We have aged past old in that caldera created of spite and hate. We did not live through it. We just did not die.